How We Built Our Team is a podcast that talks to successful founders and leaders in the hiring and recruiting space to learn their strategies for building and scaling their teams. From attracting and impressing top talent to creating a strong company culture, our guests will share their insights and experience on what it takes to build your dream team. In this episode, we talk to Barbara Gago, CEO of Pando and former CMO of Miro, VP of Marketing at Greenhouse and Culture Amp. The conversation ranges from discussing what branding actually is and how it ties into recruiting top performers, how recruiting and marketing are interconnected, and what to look for when hiring your first marketer. We also talk about a metric Pando uses called employee LTV, which helps Barbara and her team more accurately map comp to revenue projections. Stay tuned. We're really excited to have Barbara Gago today. She's the founder and CEO at Pando. She spent her career as a CMO, building and scaling tons of companies, pre-Series A all the way up to scale-up mode. In her career, she's brought companies like Culture Ramp and Greenhouse to market. And prior to founding Pando, she was the CMO at Miro, leading the rebrand from real-time board to Miro and scaling the business from 3 million to 50 million in ARR in just under 2 years, which is incredible. So welcome to the show, Barbara.
Thank you.
I want to hear from your side, your story about your journey to creating Pando and what Pando is trying to solve.
Yeah, definitely. So I would say I've been a serial early stage operator. You mentioned I had brought several companies to market. I spent my career pretty much building from almost zero. I guess Pando and founding a company is actually zero. But I've really enjoyed kind of like getting in very early and thinking about how are we going to build a brand and scale the business from a revenue side at the same time. So I have kind of an interesting mix of both left side and right side of the brain, where I'm very much focused on brand and visual and sort of the emotional sort of soft parts of marketing, but at the same time, have been really technical in building, scaling first, like really demand generation focused models for high velocity SMB and mid-market, B2B primarily. And then with Miro, of course, entering in sort of the PLG to sales motion and what that kind of overarching funnel looks like. Aside from like the actual work of being a CMO, I also have obviously been building and scaling teams alongside those companies to build those brands and scale up those marketing organizations. And I've done that primarily as a distributed leader, I guess. CultureAmp was in Australia. When I joined, Greenhouse was in New York. Miro was in Europe and I was based in San Francisco. So I've had a lot of experience working with remote teams, distributed teams, and building and scaling companies within that context. Really quick. So Pando is an employee progression platform. Our goal is essentially to kill performance reviews completely, shift the paradigm away from top-down performance management to something a bit more bottoms-up and more agile, which we frame more in the context of employee progression and something that's more always on. I spent a lot of time at Miro doing people practices in the absence of a head of HR at the time. And so I spent a lot of time thinking about recruiting and how we're going to do recruiting at scale with my experience from Greenhouse. Obviously, I was able to help the company think about structured recruiting and doing those sorts of things. And then I spent a lot of time on career development and thinking about performance and how are we going to create career paths for individuals within the organization, but also look at employee performance holistically. And there were a lot of gaps I found between how we recruit people, which is often very competency-based, and then how we measure them, which is usually just, okay, you've been here a while, let's talk about your performance. And it's kind of missing a lot of context, both for managers who might be new in their role or even experienced, as well as individuals. So Pando's really designed to help companies kind of connect the dots between how you're hiring people, at what level you hire them, what skills they need to be developing in, and then having those structured sort of career and performance conversations in a much more contextualized way and a much more iterative way over time.
Yeah, I love that. And it's so great to hear like a marketing brain building a company around, you know, restructuring performance reviews and really taking a, you know, that creative and technical side and bringing them together and realizing that you can't just grade somebody at the end of a quarter. You have to be continuously communicating over the course of their career and their time at the company, which I think is a great rethinking of like a very common misconception around performance reviews.
Like if a tennis coach or some other kind of performance-based coach waits until the end of the season to give you all the feedback, it's like, well, I could have been actually doing better on that next match if I would have known after the first match that I, you know, need to do this or need to do that. And so it's really, yeah, trying to integrate more of a philosophy that already we know works from a performance perspective, but for whatever reason, we don't do it when it comes to our people, which is like our biggest and most important resource.
Exactly. And I think that's a great segue. You mentioned that you've scaled a lot of teams and worked in people ops roles in addition to scaling marketing teams. And obviously now you are building an entire company in every department. So I'm curious to hear what that difference is. How does your strategy change and your approach change for those two types of scenarios?
Yeah. I mean, the good news is I've had a lot of experience founding marketing teams as the solo kind of first marketer and then having to go from there. It's definitely different now that I'm, you know, as a founder hiring across product and engineering and of course technical roles that I've never led before. I think in general, if I think about marketing, for example, or like hiring your first marketing team or your first marketer, there's this concept of like T shape when it comes to skills, where you have the breadth of skills as kind of the horizontal and the depth of skills as this like vertical, and the T is representing the combo of those two things. I think that as you scale, you obviously start to see more specialists crop up. You end up hiring for very specific roles for very specific skill sets, where that kind of depth of skill becomes very important. And of course, the earlier you are, the more kind of dynamic the roles will be and the more changing they will be. And so that's where kind of this generalist comes in. And I would say that there's still a need to have a little bit of specificity, especially when it's a marketing organization, depending on what the business model is or the revenue model. If it's a self-serve and product-led growth, for example, you're probably going to want to hire someone who's still generalist, but like a little bit more specialized in product marketing, where they can talk about the product, run experiments, versus if it's still kind of like a traditional B2B, maybe through sales or through marketing, you're going to want to find somebody who has more demand gen experience or account-based marketing. And so I think that generally speaking, founding teams are going to have some relative level of specialty, like, okay, you're in product design, engineering, marketing, whatever it is. But I think it's a pretty big requirement to be able to kind of toggle between different levels of specialist and generalist for different things and kind of pop in and out of stuff. As a founder, I've seen other founders do this, and it's, you know, you get kind of caught up in logos, like, oh, this person worked at Google or Uber or I don't know, some big name, and you'd swayed by that. But those companies are so different from a startup at this point, obviously. They were like a really good example of a startup decades ago, and now they're big, massive companies. And so I think it's really important to think about that. And also in the recruiting process, that's where it really comes in terms of what skills are you actually assessing for and making sure that you're interviewing for those skills, which will help someone be successful in your context.
Yeah, I love that framework, the idea of the what spikes they have and where their skill set really seems to peak. Just out of curiosity, as a marketer myself, I'm curious to know if you have an opinion on what avenues or channels are becoming more beneficial to know more about For example, like, is it better to have more of a skill set in product marketing in this day and age when PLG is becoming more the norm? Or is demand gen still, you know, a growing field, even despite dark social and other things that are hard to track?
I think that, like, yeah, PLG is really trendy and everybody wants to do some part of it, but that doesn't necessarily mean that your business will be successful with it. For example, like Pando, you could build a company like Pando potentially that is self-serve and product-led growth, but we actually are helping companies adopt a new methodology similar to what Atlassian tools did with agile practices. And so the practice and the philosophy and the methodology is part of a learning curve, where it doesn't necessarily make sense to just throw somebody in because we're trying to change a behavior. And it takes more than just a software. Of course, it's people, process, and then tools. And so we actually are part of the journey with our customer to actually get that behavior change. I think early days of Greenhouse was similar. We were introducing structured recruiting when the existing kind of tools were things like JobVite, if anybody even remembers them. And all the rage back then was social recruiting. And it was like, okay, we're just going to get people, we're going to promote these jobs on social media, and then you have a list of candidates. And that was like the innovation of recruiting at the time. There's a lot of different models. So I think that the skill set is really, it needs to be based on that. And I don't think it's like, oh, everybody just needs to be good at PLG now. Like, that's just not.
Yeah.
I don't agree. Like, I don't think that's the case.
Yeah. No, I hear that. You know, PLG is having a moment, but we don't know how long that moment is going to last. But obviously, you have a ton of experience building really great world-class marketing teams. When do you know that you're ready to hire your first marketer?
I think there's two things to consider. One is, do you have product market fit? If you do, then it's time to scale. And if it's time to scale, then you should be looking at marketing. Even if you have a product-led approach, marketing would be great to bring in earlier rather than later to build kind of long tail strategies like SEO, content, thought leadership, etc., which won't necessarily give you the results right away for something like PLG, but like in a year, you will have done all this work that makes your brand more common. I think if you don't know if you have product market fit, then getting somebody that has a deep expertise in product marketing is a way to help you test out some hypotheses and really understand and talk to users and talk to buyers and understand what those key things are, which is where product marketing really shines from like a strategic perspective. It kind of depends on the mix of if your founders have experience in marketing or not. If you have product market fit or not. And of course, if you have a sales team, you always should have marketing sooner rather than later. When I joined at Greenhouse, I think I was the 13th hire, and there was already like 4 sales reps. So that was good. They were doing like outbound and we had some good word of mouth, but that was like, it was a good time. Because they would have run out of stuff, basically. So they were still getting results. And then we brought in marketing so that I could essentially build the short term kind of how are we going to get more qualified leads to sales in conjunction with like building the brand and sort of laying the strategy for long term.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. I'm curious to know, so as you were, you know, brought on 13th hire at Greenhouse, first marketer, what were some of those initial roles that you brought onto your team? And what were the reasons why? And then a second question I have is a little bit separate, but how do you then manage marketing folks to outcomes, especially for the things that are a little bit less tangible, like brand or event marketing, not quite so immediately or obviously data-driven, yeah, like demand gen?
So when I joined Greenhouse, I had kind of like a demand gen content marketing background. And I think that because we were sort of figuring out if ATS was the right category or if it was a different category or what was happening there, And because Greenhouse had such a different approach to recruiting than other tools at the time, the thought leadership, the top of funnel positioning, the laying a foundation for search engine optimization, all of that stuff through content was really important. It's always pretty important to start that. Everybody has a website, obviously, and you need to build domain authority if people are going to find you. And it's really hard because there's so much content that's created. So it's kind of a table stake that you need content and ways to kind of build that presence and authority online. So we hired somebody that was kind of in the umbrella, I would say, of inbound marketing, really focused on how are we bringing people to us? How are we helping them discover us? And then the other kind of paired role with that was somebody who was more focused on lead generation and aligning with sales on how many leads do they, like how many opportunities do they need to close every month? How many leads, how many MQLs does that mean that we need to generate? And doing programs that specifically identified where we could find more mid-funnel leads. So we had all of these programs at the top of the funnel. And then we also went specifically looking for channels and avenues that would deliver more mid-funnel. And this was obviously in the short term. As we built and scaled the team, we created those mid-funnel leads ourselves by nurturing, you know, through the funnel over time. You know, we build a database over years and then you have a lot of leads to nurture. So it was kind of a combination of somebody who could start the foundation of that long-term stuff. Like you Google things and you can Google things now and still find stuff that we did, you know, in 2013 or 14, right? Like they're still generating traffic basically. And at the same time, we need results for sales right now, or at least soon. So what are we doing from that perspective? And how are we getting more already kind of pre-qualified leads in the funnel? So I think having a balance between those and thinking about both of them is important, and not like over-indexing in one or the other, because if you do just focus on leads, then maybe you'll get the leads. But then at some point, it's like you need this extra lift and you don't have it because you haven't been doing all of the other work. I think from a measurement and outcomes perspective, I've always been held accountable for a revenue number. I've asked for that. I don't think a lot of marketers do that, but I always had it as part of my comp plan. And goals to basically be associated with end revenue. So not MQLs, not leads. Those were all an ends to a means to an end. Like how many do we actually need and how is that going to help us understand what our budget is? But ultimately it's revenue that mattered. And so everyone in, well, for the most part, like people on my teams have also been very much oriented and aligned with revenue. It helps with collaboration with sales. It makes it a lot easier. But I think from a brand or events perspective, for me, brand is also kind of a long-term investment that you believe will make a difference or not. I think it does matter a lot this day and age in terms of differentiation and really defensibility, I think. Like the better the brand you have, the more people feel connected to it, the more defensible you are from competition in the future. And so even though it's not easy to measure, it's important to make an investment. It doesn't mean that you have to go spend millions on brand marketing, especially if you're early stage and growing. It just means that you should care about having slightly better swag or, you know, high quality things where that people actually touch and feel. Like we just did an event in Las Vegas. Okay, socks, very much a common thing that people do. But these are 100% modal cotton, like very high quality, and that is costing us more to do. But it's like a little thing that makes a big difference. Like it has this quality connection in people's mind. They feel it. They want those socks. I don't know why. I mean, they are really comfortable.
they're nice.
So I think it's those things. Like, we always approached the brand at Greenhouse. We do this at Pando. I definitely did that at Miro as well, as a consumer brand, even as a B2B product. And creating quality swag is a good example of like brand investment that most companies won't make, but I promise you it makes a difference. I think it's a little bit of a leap of faith that you have to make in terms of measurement. I think events are a little bit easier. You can see how many net new leads you get or how many leads converted after attending that event. It's a little bit easier to see that touch point versus the brand, which is kind of like you either are like supporting of brand marketing or you're not. And hopefully you are.
Yeah, I think that's also something we've noticed just across the board, especially with early stage companies, how important the website is, because that's where candidates are going to first hear about you, and they're going to research you in many different places, but very specifically your website, and how much of an impact that has.
I mean, the brand is, when you talk about Google, you don't like talk about the Google candidate brand and the Google like company brand or whatever, I guess I'll forget now. But like, the brand is everything synonymous with the people at the company, the experience that customers have, the product, the interactions, like all of those things equals brand. And if you're trying to recruit and like recruit high performers, that also has a big impact. If they know about it, if they think it looks good, as you mentioned, if the website looks like a good website, if it's modern.
Right. Yeah, that's why we call it employer brand. It like shouldn't be that different from your real brand. I know at Miro you focus on creating this new category around visual collaboration, but you also took on so much of the recruiting function and kind of the head of people needs. What do you think kind of the natural crossover between marketing and recruiting? We've just touched on it a little bit. And why did that kind of make sense for you?
I think HR oddly has a number of overlaps with marketing. Just if you think about communication and being able to communicate with people, marketing, that's all it is about. So I ended up oftentimes doing a lot of internal communication structuring and also a strategy around internal communication. I think sometimes these functions can actually roll into marketing. At Greenhouse, employer branding did, for example, because there was so much overlap with the work. I think that branding 100%, like the marketing team at Miro did all of the internal flag and brand and assets when we did company offsites and stuff like that. So there's a big, I would say even campaign component to how employees expect to experience work now, especially with distributed work. And so there's a lot of marketing actually that happens with between HR or people teams and employees, the whole communications brand marketing piece. I would say thinking about kind of structure and scalability of programs, people teams are even adopting some product methodologies and thinking about design sprints and kind of iterating programs, getting feedback from users and customers, which is the employee base, rather than just like rolling out programs and then seeing that they don't get any results because they didn't get any feedback or do any research before. I think recruiting, there's a direct overlap with the funnel. I talked earlier about, you know, building the funnel at Greenhouse with inbound marketing and then more demand gen. And I think recruiting is exactly the same. You have a lot of programs that you're running to try and get top of funnel candidates, which are more of your inbound, and then you also will do targeted outreach for either different types of groups or different types of roles, and really thinking about the data and the pipeline, which is a more modern approach to recruiting, of course. I think structured recruiting paved the way for a lot of that and being able to have recruiting look more like a pipeline. And then even as far as like the mirror between B2B marketing organizations and sales, where marketing is enabling the sales team, I think, you know, interviewers, I hope, if they want good results out of their interviews with interview kits and context and questions that make the process faster, but also improve that employee experience. So I think that a lot of stuff has been borrowed from what we've learned on the customer side, which is where the revenue comes from, and trying to model that as much across the business as we can. And the people org and recruiting certainly has borrowed many things that have improved things on that side.
Yeah, I've thought a lot about the parallels, but I've never really thought through enablement of interviewers versus salespeople. So I think that's interesting. What were some of the data components for building a structured recruiting pipeline that you feel are most important?
I think it's just like looking at conversion rates. So if you're, there's a couple different big groups, I guess. There's like looking at conversion rates through the pipeline, and are they healthy, or is nobody getting past the first stage? And if they aren't, then why is that happening? Or is everybody that gets to stage four or the onsite getting to offer? So there's like stage conversion metrics, I guess, that is probably the most telling. Obviously, similarly with marketing, we look at like the sales cycle. So how long does it take from a lead to be open to a lead to close to revenue? So there's that component as well in terms of when you open a job and, you know, time to hire, offer acceptance, all of those kind of things, I think, are pretty common aspects.
Yeah, that's very similar to a lot of the metrics that we have within Dover that people can kind of set up and track. One thing that we've been hearing a lot from Dover customers and sort of this market downturn we're experiencing is how to benchmark compensation during a recession. When we spoke a few weeks ago, you mentioned that a better way to kind of think about salaries and how much they'll actually cost your organization is with the metric that you coined employee LTV. Can you maybe talk a little bit more about that formula and why you feel like it's a better metric for retention and company success?
Sure. So I think in terms of benchmarking compensation, I think there's like a number of different ways that companies can go about that. We do salary reviews once a year, and we separate that from performance. And it's just like, what does the data say? And then, okay, anybody who's impacted sort of gets their comp adjusted. From a overall kind of how are we thinking about what the impact employees have and how that ties to their compensation because of their performance. This is where the employee lifetime value concept comes in. We actually came up with this while I was at Greenhouse and talked a lot about it there. But there, it's basically borrowed from the sales and marketing side, which is lifetime value of a customer. This is a common metric that you think about. And then there's a ratio of like cost to value. And you really want to understand like how much does it cost to acquire a company? And then what is the overall lifetime value that you get out of it, which is, let's say, 2 or 3 years worth of revenue. And of course, you want that number to be higher. So maybe it's like 3 to 1 or whatever it is. And I think that we can look at employees in this light as well. So essentially, the total value that an employee can create is the outcome of how quickly they're onboarded, how quickly they have an impact, how long they stay at the company, how engaged they are, et cetera. And so there's a bunch of levers across that that you can increase or improve to increase that overall lifetime value. I guess the hypothesis or the thesis or whatever is like, if you can speed up how quickly someone gets contributing in their role, and you can have a very clear set of steps, which is like their career progression to the next level, and you can create more opportunities to keep growing. So we often see in companies, they have 6 levels, and then most engineers will sit at like level 4, and then you're just a level 4 for like 5 years. Maybe you get paid more each year because the company is doing some inflation updates, and then they just try to tell you that's a merit increase, but really it's just because they the comp plans change, it's really not motivating. And ultimately, they're going to feel this lack of career progression and likely leave. It's the number one reason that people do leave companies in every single report that you read. And so we're really trying to help companies think about like creating more steps, have those steps be more iterative so that people can have more mobility and not be blocked in a certain level, but then just incrementally increase how much money they make. With Pando, you can kind of do this and see this in real time. And so this will ultimately get people, organizations to even closer to a sales and marketing organization in the sense that you could like forecast costs. So really understanding what the growth rate of employees are based on how they're growing over time, and then tying that with those comp projections to be able to say like, okay, you know, next quarter, 20% of the CS org is going to level up and it will cost this much. So this is something that we're really excited about and is a much more agile and sort of modern approach to thinking about not just employee performance, but also really unlocking this human potential that you have in your organization, which often just gets blocked because of stupid things like we have six levels or you have to wait until the end of the year when we do performance reviews. If I was, as a marketer, waiting until the end of the year to double down on my top performing lead sources, I would have like left so much revenue on the table. And so it's really thinking about how do we really remove those roadblocks, optimize how employees are performing, can perform, and grow at the organization.
Yeah, I love that. I think there's a lot of blockers, not only a lot of the time internally and across these different leveling structures, but also within tools themselves. And that's why I think at Dover, we're working on automating a lot of these more tedious recruiting tasks. And even though recruiting and marketing have a lot of crossover, I do think that marketing tools are way more ahead and advanced in terms of automation and taking a lot of that off of a marketer's plate. But we've experienced sort of the opposite on the recruiter side, which is that recruiters don't necessarily want a lot of those things automated and are slower to adopt newer technologies. And I'm curious to hear, as somebody who was in this space for a really long time, why do you think that is? Why do you think marketers and marketing tools are way more adept at automation than recruiting tools are?
I think first, marketing and sales are closest to revenue. So it's like we have bigger budgets. I mean, I'm selling an HR tool, you're selling an HR tool, you talk to HR and they're like,
Right.
I'm like, this is literally peanuts. Are you serious? Like you can afford, you know, 10K or 15K or whatever. Like this is not a big deal because I know what marketing has to spend on software. But marketing also can justify the spend because there's results and need and all of that. So I think that's probably the main thing. At the same time, it's just part of the learning curve too, because I started like earlier in my career before Greenhouse and CultureAmp, I was working in the marketing automation space. So this was like 2010, like old school, when HubSpot was just coming out as like this inbound marketing platform. It wasn't even all it was today. That was like the new thing. Like, oh, we don't just batch and blast. It was all just email marketing before that. Similar to the parallel of like JobBite and Greenhouse. Like Greenhouse was the marketing automation of recruiting at the time, which was a few years later, even I think like actually, yeah, 3 or 4 years later. So like at that time, for marketers, it was also new. Automation was new, and it was a very dangerous thing. And I think that's why HR probably care so much about it, is you don't want to like burn or fatigue people out by automating tools that are supposed to be like people oriented. But I think it's also just part of the learning curve. Like HR organizations, in my mind, have been like the last frontier. I'm sure there's finance or accounting orgs that are like, no, we are. And they're also getting new tools and everything. But like, if you think about an organization from like who touches the customer all the way back, even though HR customer is internal and therefore should be much more oriented around customer experience, which is now, you know, employee experience, I think it's just a fact of like, we put the money where the customers are and where the revenue is, and then it's kind of going backwards from there. So I think it's just, I would say, a matter of time and getting comfortable and seeing the results. Even in the early days of marketing automation, if you just automated everything, you would have failed. It was, again, like the people, the process, and then the tools. Like, you need to be able to have everybody on board with like, what is the philosophy? What is the approach? How are we going to do this? And then, by the way, here's all the content and all the things and all the thinking that needs to happen before you then go like program some tool to be automating that stuff. So it's like a lot of work before you even get to the tool. And I think that's a big part of it as well. Just like, I have a million things to do. There's like a fire every minute. And then you want me to think about all this stuff because I can't just like automate it. I have to like have intention, right?
Right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think that's something that we've experienced as well too. And especially I've experienced as a marketer, even with new tools, it's like there is some level of oversight as things sort of ramp up and flush themselves out and get more polished.
So let's see, we're down to a last couple questions before we wrap up here. One thing I do want to touch on, so we've talked a bit about your time at Greenhouse and leading go-to-market there. What were some of the beliefs that people had about recruiting that kind of were deemed incorrect as you were sort of redefining what structured recruiting looked like at that time? And how did you address those in the go-to-market?
I think the biggest thing was that recruiting was not strategic and they didn't bring any value. Like, this was what most recruiting teams at that time were. Essentially, here's a stack of candidate resumes. That's it. I did my job. And if we're going back to the parallels of marketing and recruiting, at some point in the not so distant past, marketing was also, you know, here's all the leads and I did my job. And now it's like, nah, like, no, we need qualified leads and they need to be, what's the ICP and all of this stuff, right? So marketing obviously also started at a place like that and has evolved and become more sophisticated. I think that was probably the biggest hurdle that we had to overcome. And we actually tried, because marketing automation was a new category. I had been already kind of doing some category creation prior to joining Greenhouse. And so one of the things that we did very early was like, okay, maybe we're a different category. Like, ATSs fucking suck. Nobody likes their ATS. It's terrible. And because of them, like, everybody thinks recruiting sucks too. So maybe we're just something else. We're not an ATS. Like, we're going to be recruiting optimization platform or whatever. Like, we came up with a few things. Our first summit was the recruiting optimization summit. We were trying to see if this could stick. And ultimately we found that wasn't going to stick. Everybody had a budget for ATS. It was a very established category already, and they weren't going to budge. They weren't going to call it something else. And so our mission then became, how do we make this category more valuable? How do we empower these people organizations with the tools and the knowledge and the insight to actually have influence and make a difference in the organization? So the whole strategy, really, from a marketing perspective, and the product was obviously delivering on that, became, how do we make this category actually valuable? How do we make these buyers more influential? And we had a strategy around, you know, we had our personas like, okay, this is the person that's the visionary in the organization, and this is the doer. And we had these for customers as well. So like, how are we creating advocates out of them? But ultimately, yeah, it was really about changing the conversation around what recruiting was and why it was so important, and also empowering with tools beyond the product, like concepts like employee lifetime value or we did a lot of interview kits that were, you know, editable PDFs that you could get used to interview kits and the concept of interview kits and structure without having the tool. Like just really going out and helping people understand why this stuff is so important and giving them tools to become more strategic. That was like one of our goals at some point. Like, what can we do to empower this person at this company to actually do the work through recruiting that's going to get them either their next job or promoted into, you know, a senior level? It's not easy work. And this is not, but that's like going back to the beginning with the whole PLG, you know, if everything is PLG or not, like this is an example of no, like we had to do that training. We had to change that. We had to make that behavior change happen.
Hey, that's really interesting. And I think that's really, it speaks to the idea that like human behavior is just so vast that we can't necessarily predict. We can see patterns, but we can't predict what everyone's going to do. And before we close out here with some really quick rapid fire questions, I'm curious to know, when it comes to category creation or building a brand or trying to figure out where you fit in this category, especially one that's really massive, like applicant tracking systems, for example, as an early stage founder, what are some tactical ways that you can sit down with your team and brainstorm? Like, what are some strategies that you enacted at Greenhouse or, you know, Miro or at Pando to sort of build up these positioning statements?
It all comes back to, like, we're just reflecting what we hear. Like, I just spent a lot of time with customers and asked them a lot of questions, and they said smart stuff that I repackaged. So it's really not like, oh, we're so brilliant. We have all of the answers. Like, if you sit down and really talk to people and just why, like keep digging into what's behind what they're saying, because it's up to you to kind of like decipher and translate what that actually means. Because with Pando, for example, when I did talk to a lot of customers, but I also had a lot of experience in this space and I was a manager myself with the pain. When I first started telling people about it and showing them, they were like, how did I not think of it? Like people leaders, they were like, how did I not think of this? How does this not exist already? And I really think it's just like the combination of listening and sort of identifying the unspoken thing that's being said, but not being said. I think tactically there's like simple things that you could do. For example, thinking about the funnel and sitting down with your sales leader and even customer success and marketing and looking at it and being like, okay, what questions come up for people at the top of the funnel? Like when they're just exploring or when they're looking for solutions or when they get through to different stages, like what are the actual questions that people ask? And then how do you respond to that? And those answers can then become kind of like statements and messaging and value propositions and things like that, but and that are directly aligned to what somebody is looking for and what they're asking for.
Yeah. No, I think that's also just really important to reiterate is I don't know that marketing teams think about talking to the customer enough. I think it's like something that's often been siloed as a product thing that or a product task versus a marketing task. And I think the more we talk to our customers, it's like
that's a huge mistake.
Yes, exactly. It's the more we talk to our customers, the more we learn exactly what we need to be building and selling and what we need to be writing. You know, it sort of writes itself.
Yeah, and saying, like you just reflect back what they're saying and then they think you're a genius because they think they're a genius and everybody's a genius.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Well, Barbara, this has been a really incredible conversation. I know that I've gotten a lot out of this, and I know our listeners are going to get a ton of really great advice and tactical tips. Really quickly, before we say goodbye, we have four rapid fire questions that are less professional and a little bit more about you personally. So I'll start off. This is a little bit more on the recruiting side, but what is your favorite interview question to ask candidates?
So I always ask, what are your top 5 accomplishments in life. Just, it could be anything. I was asked this once and it was 10. So people struggle with 5. I'm like, okay, well, I had to do it with 10. But I really like it because it helps you kind of understand where people's values are and how quantitative someone is versus qualitative. And it also helps you get to know them. So it's like a really good bang for your buck question in terms of like how they think, how they measure success, what they believe is an accomplishment, what level of those are like personal versus professional.
I also love being asked those questions too, I think, as someone being interviewed. So that's always great. What's an all-time favorite book that you'd recommend?
There's a few. There's one called Ishmael that I really love by Daniel Quinn. It's actually a part of a 3-series book. It's relatively, it's pretty relevant to like the world now and all the hell in a haybasket, in which we're in and going to.
Right.
But in a really nice way. And there's also a book by Murakami called Copped on the Shore that I really love. So yes. I've read a lot of professional business books, but it's just, you know, you read so much at work and it's much nicer to kind of read a story when you need to take a break.
Yes. Yeah.
So those are both stories.
Yeah, totally. Okay. I'll jump in on the next two. So where do you physically go in the world to spark inspiration? Is there a place that comes to mind?
I moved to Amsterdam, so that's just generally inspiring to be in Europe because I can go to many lovely places. I tend to like to wander around museums and just look at stuff, or outdoors, but yeah, like nature, I guess. But no, I would say like museums actually are probably, if I'm looking for inspiration specifically, that.
What kind of museums do you like to go to?
I mean,
like art museums?
Yeah. Yeah. Any kind of museum though, like photography, art, modern.
What's general. Your favorite museum in Amsterdam? Which ones have you been to?
I mean, the Van Gogh Museum is nice. It's just, I mean, it's
that's
very,
yeah,
it's very
ever.
Focused and the art is amazing. But the Rijksmuseum is also very nice. I really also love like the Met Gallery in, or the costume exhibit in the Met Museum in New York.
I love that.
I always go there when I'm in town. Yeah. It's just, I mean, that I used to live in New York and I lived on 49th and I would just walk up and then I was on the west side. I would go through the park and just go to the Met exhibit every time there was a new costume exhibit and just like.
I know there's something so magical. Yeah.
Okay. Final question for you. What's something that you're really looking forward to?
I'm literally leaving tomorrow morning to fly to Jacksonville, Florida, for a retreat that Troop HR is doing at the Ritz-Carlton on Amelia Island. So it's like an executive retreat for their HR leader members. And I'm going alongside someone from my team and we're going to be doing a workshop at the event, but it's not like a trade show. It's very much like there's content and there's like going to be a lot of conversation, but it's also like at the beach and
so nice
with sun. So yeah, a little bit of lounge time, work and play combo.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So that's kind of combo.
Yeah,
that's great.
Well, again, thank you so much, Barbara.
How We Built Our Team is produced by Dover, a recruiting operations platform that helps you attract and engage the best talent. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere else that you listen to podcasts.